This is going to be same old, so I'm going to do it fast. So we've done spin zero, and this is this kind of too loud? Are you? Is not okay. So for n spin zero particles, the we kind of did the most general quadratic Lagrangian consistent with motherhood gives the free Hamiltonian for non-interacting spinless particles. For n Majorana spinners, the same argument gave you the Hamiltonian for free non-interacting spin and half particles. And so I want to do spin one, and you know, we could do spin three halves, we could do spin two. And but spin one is where we'll stop, because for the standard model that's all we need. But also because this is the first place you see something more interesting happen, in a sense that for spin zero and spin a half, the massless and massive cases were really the same case, and it's a special case of one parameter was zero or not. And so for massless and massive spin one particles, it's qualitatively different how things behave, and that's ultimately because the particle states, you know, for massive particles, massive spin n particles, the states are labeled by their momentum and their helicity. Say helicity h. Where you can think of h as being the angular momentum projected in the direction of motion of the momentum. And h is basically plus or minus n. So there's just two states there, whereas massless is what that was. Whereas for massive, you know, spin n, then states are labeled by p and sigma, where sigma is just the third component of angular momentum of a spin n thing. And so sigma runs from minus n to n in steps of one. So that just, you know, for spin a half, you have two states either way. For spin zero, you've got one state either way. But for spin one, you have two states here and three states here. And for spin three halves, you've got two states here and four states here. So the mismatch in the number of states starts at one and increases. And so that's partly why there's a difference in the description. So we have to look at them separately. So you won't be surprised that in both cases, or what's in the massive case, the field that you're led to as being the simplest one to use to represent a spin a half, spin one particle is a vector field. So there's again a sum, you know, zero plus or minus one integral over momenta times some wave function, which I'm going to call a polarization vector. Depends on p and sigma. Let me use sigma because this is really the massive case. EBI px, maybe p sigma. Then there's the antiparticle thing, which is again morally the complex conjugate. And again, you know how this transforms into Lorentz transformations. You know how this transforms into Lorentz transformations. It tells you what this is. And it's three independent four vectors for the three choices for sigma. And the upshot is that that these three choices satisfy the condition that epsilon mu is orthogonal to p mu. And that's an upshot of this finding what the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient is that relates this kind of transformation to this kind of transformation. That's what cuts down the four components of the four vector to the three spins that were allowed to be there. And one way to think about this is that in position space, that's like saying that the vector field satisfies div v equals zero. And the reason that there's a condition is related to the fact that there's, if you go back and ask what kinds of particles could I have expected to represent using a vector field, the answer is not unique. You could represent a spin one particle with a vector field, but you could also represent a spin zero particle with a vector field. And morally speaking, what you would have found if you did the spin zero particle here is that this would have had to have been proportional to P, which is like saying that V is the gradient of some scalar field. And so this condition that you're getting by the condition that this thing represents a spin one particle is projecting out the spin zero part of this vector field. So that's kind of where that's coming from. But again, it's the same logic as before. It's just ultimately a Clebsch-Gordan issue in the Lorentz group. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that should have been the complex conjugate. Is that what you mean? They need not be different. There has to be, this is the, it's always true that there has to be some antiparticle which has the same mass as the particle. They need not. Well, it's the same thing as for if we, when we did the scalar field. This was basically the same because it was one, you know, at some level. And for the vector for the spinner field, this was the spinner which was related to the complex conjugate of this one. So the how this is related to this is just to do with this Clebsch-Gordan calculation. That if I know how this thing transforms, I know how this thing transforms. I know how what this is, and I know how this thing transforms. It transforms essentially as a complex conjugate of this thing, because it has the same mass and the same spin. So that's more or less why I'm getting complex conjugates of these things here all the time. The issue of whether or not this is this, I could have equally well written that the particle had the antiparticle was not distinct. Yeah. Well, just because when I actually told you what V was, I told you it was basically the complex conjugate of U. And so I could have written this as V or some other thing, and then later on told you it was complex conjugate of the first thing. But I'm just telling you straight out that this is. Then that's a separate issue from whether or not this is whether the antiparticle and the particle are distinct. And again, I have no coins. This is the way I have to go. Is I come with no coins, otherwise you're going to get rich for me, because that definitely has to be complex conjugate here. Any other questions? All right. So when we're looking for a Lagrangian, the upshot is that the logic is the same as before, with the extra proviso that we want this to come out as a consequence of the Lagrangian. And so that means that unlike previously, we just took everything we could possibly take, and that was the answer. And we just found that the parameters that were left were the ones that described physically what was going on. The change here will be that if we write down some generic thing involving vectors, as I am about to do, we shouldn't expect that the generic thing will give us the theory of free, non-interacting, that's redundant, spin one particles. What we should expect is the one that implies that this is true will boil down to having n plus 1 parameters describing non-interacting spin 1 particles. So what, in practice, what I'm going to do is, it was always true that the equations of motion told us that, you know, that we knew that the energy was, as a function of momentum, was the square root of the momentum squared plus m squared. And so that was the same thing as saying that p mu plus m squared was equal to 0. And that was the same thing as saying in position space that the field satisfied d mu minus m squared phi or psi or v mu was equal to 0. So we're going to still ask for, this has been equation of motion automatically for the generic thing we've written down before, but we're going to ask for this and this to be consequences of the equation of motion for the Lagrangian that we get. And that'll be an additional constraint on these parameters that we're going to have. There's kind of any of these things, you can, any particles, any spin, you've got two complementary ways of thinking about it. You can think about it in terms of just the algebra of the Lorentz transformations, or you can think about it from the point of view of equations of motion in a Lagrangian, and they're telling you the same thing, and I'm kind of giving it to you both ways here so you see how they're related. So what do we, so let me do it for one. So the story will be the same as it would have been for if we had n. And what I want to do is focus on this particular issue. So I'm going to do this for one vector field. And then the generalization to n, where we then diagonalize everything, is that it would be the same as it was for the spinless and the spin a half. So in the case of for one field, what could we write down? You know, we have always the freedom to write a constant. Now we're trying to write down things that have that are scalars. So we can always write down, you know, b times v mu, v mu. That's the only thing we can write down, which is at most quadratic in V and which has no derivatives. Can't write anything linear because it's not a four, it's a four vector and wouldn't be a scalar. If we include derivatives, then you know we could have written down something like this with one V, but that's a total derivative, so we don't need to write it down because we're not including those things. So if we're throwing away total derivatives, there's nothing we can write down with one field, so we have to have two fields. If we have two fields, we have to have at least two derivatives to make all the indices contract and become Lorentz invariant. So there's two possibilities that are independent. We could have had d mu v nu, d mu v nu. We could have had d mu v nu and then change the order here, d nu v mu. And anything else we can get by integrating by parts, right? We could have anything with the two derivatives on one V, I could always integrate one of them by parts onto the other V. So it's enough to think of things where they're both differentiated once. And then once they're both differentiated once, this is the only independent ways we can contract the indices. So the claim is that that's it for one field. That's all you could do. So now the equations of motion you would have got for this Lagrangian would have been, so if we take variation of the action and we ask for this to be zero, then we're going to get minus two V mu. So here, if we vary this thing, we're going to have to integrate by parts. So we'll get plus two C. So the index that's going to be contracted will be with V. So it'll be d nu V mu. And then again, we'll have to integrate by parts in this one. So we'll get plus two D d nu d mu v nu is equal to zero. That's the equation of motion for this coming from this. So if I rewrite that, I can write that as question. They should all be up or down, and strictly speaking, it should be up the way I did it here. If I didn't write this was equal to this, but it's true that if I'd strictly done it, it'd be up. Any other questions? So if I've done this right, what we're looking for is when can we learn that this is equal to zero from this equation? And so the simplest thing to do is to take the divergence of that whole equation. So if we take the d mu of all that stuff, that's got to also be equal to zero because that's zero. And so that says that once we cancel the two, it says that d mu. Oh, I missed a b here, didn't I? Yeah, you're right. Thank you. So I get minus b plus c plus d box div v equals zero. Box is just, you know, partial mu, partial mu. So that's the equation of motion that we get by differentiating again. Now, if C, so here's the point. So if C plus D is not zero, then if you imagine this being some sort of a field, you know we can find solutions to box plus a constant on the field is equal to zero, which do not imply the field to be equal to zero, right? Because we didn't say if we had this equation being true that phi had to be zero, right? There were lots of solutions of this equation which were not zero. And so if C plus D is not zero, this equation will not imply that div v is equal to zero. The only way that we can get have these equations imply that div v has to be zero and not some specific function of x would be to have c equal minus d. And in that case, we just have the conclusion that b times this is equal to zero. So what we're going to do is require c plus d equals zero in order to ensure that d mu v mu equals zero for all solutions. So with that choice, the Lagrangian would become minus a minus b v mu v mu minus c d mu v nu v mu v mu minus d nu v mu. And so it's impossible to stay your hand from writing this as being minus A, and I'm going to call this B prime over 2, C prime over 2, sorry. F mu nu, 4. Where F mu nu is the curl of V. So if I just write this out, this would have been C prime over 2 times this. But if I just expand this out, it's the same thing as what I've written there. So I just, B is B prime over 2, and C is C prime over 2. Now, I'm free, as usual, to rescale fields. If I only have one field, I can do field redefinitions that are linear. But for one field, that just means rescaling it by some factor. And so I can use this rescaling to get rid of C. So as long as C is positive, and C will have to be positive in order to have the energy be positive or unbounded from below. So I can choose lambda to be 1 over the square root of C prime, and choose in that way that C prime is 0, is 1, sorry. So once I've done that, so choose lambda such that C prime equals 1, and then L will be just minus A, minus 1/2. Now I'm going to call this mu squared v mu, minus 1/4 f mu nu. So mu squared is what used to be b prime. It's really b prime over a prime, c prime. Because once I've rescaled lambda, it's going to also rescale this. So that's also B over C. And I'm doing that because if we ask what the equations of motion are again, you can check that the equation of motion for V is basically box minus mu squared V mu equals 0. And so mu is going to play the role of the mass like it has been doing up until now. Alternatively, what you could do is you could take this thing and you could construct the Hamiltonian canonically the way you're supposed to construct Hamiltonians, and you could ask, can it be written in the form of the free particle Hamiltonian? And the answer would have been yes, it can. And the energy would have been this, where that was mu. And that would have also told you that this thing is the mass. And if we had n of these fields, then everybody's a matrix. You know, VAB, VA, VB, you know, yada, 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 yada. And it's the same story as before, that you can diagonalize the mass term and make it all. The kinetic terms, provided they're strictly positive, can be scaled away by a matrix transformation of this form, where now we've got a matrix here rather than a number. And once you've done that, this kind of a term is going to become a real symmetric matrix, which you can diagonalize with an orthogonal transformation, because orthogonal transformations will not change the nice form you've made the kinetic term have. And so it's the usual spiel that we had for the scalars. Any questions about that? That's kind of a... The new thought is just this... this requirement here, which basically is the analog of this requirement here, and that's the following from the fact that we've chosen massive versus massless, and they're really different in how they transform under Lorentz group. So although this isn't changing, if you thought of it as a vector field, how this thing transforms depends crucially on which one of these we're talking about. And that was all, the necessity to restrict the Lagrangian was basically falling from this fact that we now have qualitatively different behavior if the mass is zero or not. Yeah? Which requirement? This one? It's the same reason that the, not this morning, but the last time we met, I told you that the U spinner is satisfied IP slash plus M U is equal to 0. And the way I first motivated that was that if you went to the rest frame for the particle, it satisfied something like beta u was equal to 0, where beta was this matrix 0, 1, 1, 0. And that was a condition coming. It says that the top two and the bottom two components of the spinner are the same in the rest frame. And that's the condition that cuts the four pieces of the field in the spinner down to the two spin degrees of freedom that you know you physically have. And that is something which... I'm always saying these words, but I'm never actually doing it. If you actually did the Clebsch-Gordan thing of saying, if this thing transforms in a specific way under Lorentz transformations, and this thing transforms in a different way, then this is determined by, it's a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, and you can determine up to normalization. that determination tells you these things. And because I'm not doing that for you, you're not seeing why they're true, but I'm just telling you that's what happens if you do this. And these notes that I'll distribute once I get them back from Michael will just show that in more detail. And this is the same thing. It's the spin one. For vectors, you get this. For spinners, you get this. For other fields, you get some else. Yeah. Because the thing that doesn't satisfy this would be v mu being d mu of phi. And that certainly doesn't represent a spin 1 particle because it's going to represent a spin 0 particle. So the Clebsch-Gordan algebra can't tell the difference between what you thought the vector was going to be. It just knows that you've asked for a vector. And if you kind of ask what fields can describe what particles, if you took a vector field and said what spins can I represent with a vector field, the answer turns out to be 0 or 1 for massive particles. And so the zero solution is this. If you did the Clebsch-Gordan thing for spin zero, you would have found that this polarization thing was actually proportional to p mu. And that's really just saying that you've got the gradient of a scalar field. And you knew that scalar fields were describing spin zero particles. So then if you do this for spin one particles, you have to not get the scalar field because you're asking for it to transform differently. And so that's the way it shows up, is that you learn this constraint on the epsilon. So the four field components can represent four states. Three of them are a spin 1 particle, one of them is a spin 0 particle, and these are the two options that distinguish how those four fields represent those four particle states. But if we chose to look at only a massive spin 1 particles, we're only choosing to look at these three particle states, the three states for the three spins of the spin states of the spin 1 particle. And because of that, we had to, one component of these combination of these fields has to be not doing anything, and that's what this expresses. In the same way that this expressed that of the four spinners we had, two of them were not doing anything because in the rest frame they were just being, the top is being made to be equal to the bottom. And well, let me do the massless case next, and then you can see how I'm going to match in. Before I do that, though, any other questions about the massless case? Let me leave that there. So if I did this for massless, now we're talking about massless spin one. If I tried to do this for the same thing where I asked for this to be now the destruction operator for massless spin one particle and I asked, what's this got to be? The answer is, it's got to be zero. There does not exist a solution for which this is a vector and that's a massless spin one particle. So you have to kind of go back and ask, well, so the general statement is if you have, again, this is an aside for those who know the notation, field finite dimensional representations of the Lorentz group are labeled by two spins, A and B. A vector is a 1/2, 1/2 representation. And the statement is that a massless particle of helicity lambda can be represented by one of these things if lambda is equal to A minus B. Might be absolute value, but it's something like that. And so you can kind of see right away that if you have a half, which is a vector field, you can only represent massless spin zero. You can't represent massless spin one. So what you need for helicity one would be like a 1/0 representation or a 0/1 representation, which amounts to an anti-symmetric tensor. So the first statement, which is a surprise, is that it is impossible represent, even though every QED book you've ever read says you can, they're lying to you. They're not lying to you, but there's a statement that's not being made clearly, which I'm going to hit you over, you know, beat to death up here. So, is it possible to represent a massless spin one particle by a vector field, four vector field? So the simplest case, the simplest field you can use, which can represent massless spin one, is an antisymmetric tensor field, F mu nu. And so, again, so F mu nu of X would be sum over the two helicities, integral d3p, of some polarization vector epsilon mu nu, p and lambda, e to the I px, a p lambda, and again, you say, how does this transform? How does this transform? Learn what this is. And the short version of what that is that epsilon mu nu turns out to be p mu epsilon nu minus, let me not call it epsilon because I've called that epsilon. Let's say it's p mu c nu minus p nu c mu, where c is explicitly given. Basically, C is orthogonal to P again, but it's also orthogonal to the other light-like directive, other light-like vectors besides P. So, so the simplest thing would be to say what it is in a special frame. So. So. In a frame where p mu is omega 0, 0, omega. So this is p 0 and this is p 3. So it's moving, if you're moving along the z direction with energy omega, the epsilon that's appearing there would have been lambda equals plus, could have been, I guess it would have been 1 over root 2, 0, 1, I, 0, and the minus would be minus I, so it's plus or minus I. So another way of saying that is that, P mu epsilon mu is equal to 0, and P bar mu epsilon mu is equal to 0, where P bar is another light-like vector, so for P bar mu is 0. It's also p mu, because it's massless. And p mu, p bar mu, we could choose to be, say, minus 1 or something. So it's two different light-like vectors. It's just expressing the fact that this polarization is orthogonal to these two directions, the time and the space directions in which the photon is moving. So now you say, well, I've written two inconsistent statements on the board, because I've said that this is this. And so because P is a derivative, basically, another way of saying this is that F mu nu is D mu A nu minus D nu A mu for A mu given by sum over lambda equals plus or minus 1 integral D3P C mu of P lambda E to the I PX A P lambda plus C star. So I've lied to you. Here's a vector field, which is representing a spin one particle that's massless, and I said you couldn't do it. And the thing is, it's not a lie. I didn't lie to you, because this C, since we know what C is, this is C, sorry. And this is C. I didn't want to use epsilon, because that's what I use for the massive case. Since we know what C is, we can figure out, given how this thing transforms under Lorentz transformations, and given C, we can actually calculate how F or how A transforms under Lorentz transformations. And if everything's consistent, I have to learn that this thing is not a four vector. And what happens is that it's not a four vector. If I do a Lorentz transformation, on F mu nu, I get lambda mu alpha, lambda nu beta, F alpha beta, lambda x, probably lambda inverse x. But if I do the same thing for A, so that's what it means to be a tensor. But if I do this to A, what I find is that I do get the lambdas that I'm supposed to get here. But there's an extra piece which is proportional to p mu, which is the derivative of something. I don't care what it is. You can calculate what it is, but it's not important. So the statement is that it's not wrong. You're used to thinking of a vector potential as describing a massless spin one particle, and that's true. It does, it can. But it's not a four vector when you write it in this way. It's a four vector up to a gauge transformation, which in electromagnetism you didn't care about because gauge transformations were also symmetry. So in fact, if it was the failure to be a full vector was something which is not affecting any of the physics anyway. But this shows you that if you have a massless spin one particle and you want to couple it to, we haven't talked about couplings yet, but just to skip ahead a little bit, if you want to make interactions that don't involve the momentum of the particle, so you can't use F because F involves explicitly the momentum of the particle, and in particular the Coulomb interaction has that property, it doesn't involve the momentum of the particle, then you're forced to build it out of A. And then you can only make it, if you make something which looks Lorentz invariant, it's only going to really be Lorentz invariant if it's also gauge invariant. So this shows you that the gauge invariance is a consequence of Lorentz invariance and these other motherhood things we're looking at for massless spin one particles, if you want to have it couple at low energy so that it's not suppressed by momenta. Another way to say that would be that if you try and make an interaction down the road which is renormalizable, so it survives at low energies, using F alone, you'll find there aren't any. You'll only get magnetic moment interactions, which have an intrinsic length scale in them, so they go like 1/mass. The ones that would be dimensionless, that would describe the Coulomb interaction in particular, you can only build with A, and so you have to build them in a way which is gauge invariant. And so the gauge principle that people use when they're writing down gauge interactions, which we're about to do for the standard model, in your face, all over the place, is something which you shouldn't think of as being a logically independent assumption in addition to Lorentz invariance and the motherhood principles. It's something which is a consequence of Lorentz invariance and the motherhood principles. To the extent so far that they're exactly massless. In the standard model, there's going to be an issue where there's particles that are not massless, like the W boson, which are also going to be gauge particles. And then the question is, are they mass? They're massive, but are they light compared to what? And if you want them to be, if you want your theory to apply to very large energies beyond the mass of your spin one particle, then they have to be morally massless, and so then they have to be gauge particles. And if you're prepared to have your cutoff be close to the mass of the spin one particle, then you're going to less and less require gauge invariance to make sense of it. So there's some sort of a transition between the clean and pristine cases, the massless spin one particle, where it has to be a gauge particle, and if it's not, then you're fucked. But if it's light but massive, then depending on how light it is, it may need to be a gauge particle or not, where the relevant comparison will be between the mass and the cutoff of your theory, or better said, the first things that you have not included in your theory, the masses of the particles you've neglected. So now we build, do the Lagrangian story again. And you won't be surprised that the Lagrangian, we write the most general thing, we rescale the way we're free to rescale, and we can always write the answer as -1/4 F mu nu, F mu nu. So we got exactly the mass equals zero limit of the massive case, but the route through which we came was different. And you can see that the term I didn't write here, the d mu or the v mu v nu piece, would have not been Lorentz invariant if things transformed this way. And so one way to think about this is that if you'd done the massive case and turned the mass off, you would have learned there was a new symmetry in the problem. And that symmetry is what's allowing you to represent a spin one particle with a vector field. Y'all happy? So that's something which is not emphasized normally, but it's true. Yeah. No, then it could be, if you're using what I call epsilon mu rather than xi mu, then if you just do the rank transformations, it transforms as a four vector. But the epsilons are different because they, for any given momentum, the explicit form you'd have for epsilon would be different from this. And so it's that difference that's making them transform differently. Okay. So I think I'm going to change the order a little bit from what I did in the book. Now goes into consequences of symmetries, and let me come back to that and skip ahead to the interactions, and then come back to the symmetries once we talked about interactions a little bit more. Unless there's any questions. I didn't hear you, sorry. What? Is that why gluons have to be massless? No, that's an observational statement, that if you want to describe the strong interactions, the gluons have to be massless. But given that they're massless, then they have to go with the gauge symmetry, is what this would say. Well, then it's a question, then there's this issue of how, so when you're writing any theory like this down, there's some scale above which you're not expecting to apply. And the statement would be, you know, say you're coupling, the coupling of the spin one particle was, you know, E or G, let's say, and its mass is M. Then if you did not make it, if it was massive and it was not a gauge particle, then your effective theory is going to fail. It's going to give you things you don't believe at a scale lambda of the, you know, greater than or of the order of M, you know, 4 pi M over G squared or something like that. So there's some scale like this where you're forced into trouble if you don't have a gauge invariant thing. So now it becomes a physical question. If you believe that your theory applies to scales bigger than this, given that it's got a mass and a coupling, then you're forced to make it into a gauge theory. Whereas if it happens that that there's important physics happening at this scale or lower, then you're not really going to try and trust your theory up to that scale anyway, because something else is going to come in first. And then you're not forced to make it into a gauge theory. And so, for example, if it's rho mesons or something, so that you're the physics that you're not keeping track of is QCD and things that are actually important in making it a rho meson, you can have an effective theory of rho mesons where you don't really care so much that they're gauge bosons, because you're not going to believe that theory up to energies high enough that you'd hit a problem. You'll hit some other problem first. But if you tried to take the standard model and throw the Higgs away, actually one of the things I'm going to do along the way here is take the standard model and throw the Higgs away. And that's a theory which tells you it has to break down at a scale of roughly this size, because at some point you start getting, the way that's normally presented is that this scattering of W particles starts to grow with energy in a way which can't be consistent with unitarity. And but unitarity, if you're Hamiltonian transmission, it's unitary. So that what's really happening is that your perturbative calculation of that scattering rate is failing. And if you think, well, what's the thing that failed? It's a low energy approximation that failed. And so that's again showing you that the theory you had thought was applying was telling you that it breaks down at some energy scale. And so you have to rethink things at that energy scale. And in the standard model, what happens is that the Higgs field, which is in there to make it a gauge theory, cancels out the thing that would have been dangerous at high energies and gives you something which is reasonable to very, very, very high energies. It only grows logarithmically or something as a function of energy. So then there's no self-consistent reason why it would have to fail. It may fail, but there's nothing intrinsic to the theory which says it has to fail to very high energies. So the issue is how the range, if you think your thing is applying to a scale higher than about this, then you're really forced to think, it's in the massless theory camp and it's essentially a gauge theory. And if your cutoff is lower, this or lower, then it really, you can use a massive vector field and it doesn't make a difference. If we knew that this, it would be a real problem if we knew that the standard model was true, there were no other particles, including the Higgs, to energies past a couple TeV, that would be a real fundamental problem from the point of view of just Lorentz invariant field theory. Because something should have failed in that theory with W scattering. So something has to happen there. And so, you know, one of the more interesting things if it happens that there is no physics except for what we've seen already, and nothing goes weird at that scale, then that would really be probably one of most that's be one of the most interesting things that you could learn from experiments, because that would mean something very fundamental in our understanding of field theories is wrong. But more likely, what's happening is that this is the kind of the win-win argument people made for the SSC and for the LHC, is that you can't fail to find something. And the most boring case would be to find the Higgs only, but there has to at least be the Higgs, given fairly general arguments. And if you did this for spin at 3/2, then the same thing would have been that instead of psi mu, that can represent a massive spin 3/2, but not a massless one. You should really be talking about d mu, d mu psi nu. That's the kind of thing which can describe a massless spin 3/2 thing. And again, it's only a spinner vector up to a gauge transformation, and that's the thing that tells you supersymmetry would have to be around. And if you did it for gravity, you would not be, you can't describe a massless spin 2 thing by a symmetric tensor, but you can by something which has essentially the symmetry properties of the Weyl tensor. So something which is anti-symmetric in two indices, which is in this Lorentz invariant notation, it's like a 2-0 or a 0-2 field. So something like the curvature is describing massless spin 2 things, and then you recognize if you do the Clebsch-Gordan thing, that this is something which is derivatives of a symmetric tensor, which is only a symmetric tensor up to a gauge transformation, which is essentially general covariance. And then beyond that, there's reason to believe you can't go beyond spin 2. Massless spin 2. All right. Well, you can do it for free theories, but not necessarily interacting theories. Okay. So far this has all been free. And so now, what about interactions? And the first thing to think about is the spins 0 and 1/2. Because this whole story of gauge invariance, massless versus massive spin 1 particles complicates things, so let's not talk about it for a second. So, up until now, we've been asking for the Lagrangian to be quadratic. So let's say we have N0, spin 0, and we represent those with a bunch of fields psi I. We have N½, spin 1/2 particles, and we represent those things with psi A. Then we would know what the non-interacting Lagrangian would be. It would be minus A minus sum over I let me just say so we know we can always put the quadratic or less parts of the Lagrangian into that form. And then there's going to be interaction terms, which let's just write that now as plus L interaction. And these are the things that are not quadratic. So what might they be? Whatever they are, since I haven't written them down yet, I'm always free to do the redefinitions I wanted to do to make the free thing have the canonical form. So I might as well do them. And that'll change the form the interactions had. So I just won't write them down until we've done the redefinition. So let's say we've diagonalized all the masses and we've done all the things that we did previously in the last class. And we're only going to write down this thing in this canonical basis. So this is the canonical form where the kinetic terms and the mass terms are standard. So these are, I remind you, these are real fields and I've chosen Majorana spinners here. So what are the interactions we can write down? I want to write them down in successive, involving more and more powers of fields and derivatives. And of course, you can write down more and more complicated things. But you'll see that the more complicated the interaction is you write down, the more the dimension, the coupling constant in front of it has dimensions of negative powers of mass. And so there's very few interactions you can write down which don't involve couplings involving negative powers of mass. So I want to explore that. So let's just write down everything we can possibly write down. In higher and higher powers of fields, which is going to be also related to higher and higher dimension. So since I'm, before I do this next line, I'm going to be interested in the dimensional analysis of what these couplings are in these interactions I'm going to write down. And so I should start off then saying what the dimensional analysis is of what we have here, right? Remember, the action is has the same units as h bar. It's energy times time. So if h bar is 1, the action is dimensionless. So in units where h bar and c are 1, the action is dimensionless. And so since integral d4x is length to the fourth, that's 1 over mass to the fourth, the Lagrangian should be dimensions of mass to the fourth. So let me write that as this means that the dimension of L is mass to the fourth. So the dimensions of derivatives, since that's 1 over length, that should be 1. So that's to say that of derivative is mass. The dimensions of the fields we can figure out. You know, if the derivative has dimensions of mass, and that's got dimensions of mass, and this whole thing has dimensions of mass squared, mass to the fourth, and we've designed it to have a coefficient which is 1, so there's no couplings here, then in that normalization, we know the dimensions of these fields. That has to have dimensions of mass, too, so that this will be mass, 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 and mass, and the whole thing is the mass to the fourth. So the scalar fields have to be dimension 1. And that says that mu has to have dimensions of mass, and that's good because we think it's a mass. Same thing here says that there's one derivative here. So psi bar psi has to have dimensions of mass cubed because the Lagrangian is mass to the fourth. That means that the dimensions of psi have to be 3/2, mass to the 3/2. And then that also means that this has dimensions of mass, which is good because we think it's a mass. And then A would have dimensions of mass to the fourth because it's an energy density. So it's mass per unit volume, and volume is length cubed, so that's mass to the fourth. So given that we've canonically normalized the fields, we know the dimensions of the fields, is what that says. And the important thing here is that everything here is positive. So the more powers of fields and derivatives that I put in, the more the actual operator in the Lagrangian is going to have, the larger the power of mass that it's going to have as dimensions. And so since the whole thing has to have dimensions of mass to the fourth, I'm going to be forced to multiply it by a coupling constant, which is going like more and more negative powers of mass. And that's what makes it constraining. If you want to have couplings which are not depending on inverse powers of mass at all, there's not going to be a lot of things ways you can do that. So I'm kind of leaving open why you might want to restrict yourself to not having particles of or couplings with inverse mass. But it's to do with that whole renormalization discussion we had a couple classes ago. So interaction terms, what can we write down? So we can, first of all, we could say, well, let's ignore the fermions. Or actually, let's not. Let's start with the scalars. So scalars are for free. They're Lorentz invariant by themselves. So we can take as many functions of them as we like. And it's always going to be Lorentz invariant. But let's take polynomials just to keep track of the dimensions. But we can imagine having an arbitrarily large polynomial in these fields. So if we have the first thing that's not cubic, not quartic, would be cubic. So we could have had something like g, I, j, k, I, j, phi, k. We could have had something which was quartic, I, j, k, l. We could have had something which is quintic. Let me write this as, you know, I1 to IN, II1, IIN, and so on. Those are the things involving scalars and no derivatives. I could have scalars with derivatives, so we could have put in something like, I'd have to have at least 3 fields. So I could have something like alpha ijk phi I d mu phi j d mu phi k, and other things like that. I could have things, fermions and scalars with no derivatives. So the simplest thing would be, if I have one fermion, I have to have two fermions, because the only way I can make a vector, a scalar out of, I can't make a scalar out of an odd number of spinners. So we could have YIAB psi bar A gamma left psi B phi I plus complex conjugate. So Y could be complex here, and the real part will give me things with ones, and the imaginary part will give me things with gamma fives, just like in this morning's lecture. I could have had more scalars. I could have had, ZI, J, A, B, psi bar, A, gamma left, psi B, phi I, phi J, and so on. We could have had derivatives. We could have had, W, I, A, B, psi bar A, gamma left, gamma mu, psi B, d mu, phi I, and so on. We could have had, so we got scalars, we got derivatives, we got scalars and fermions. We could have just fermions and no scalars. So we could have had L, A, B, C, D. If I only have two fermions, then I'm basically where I was before, if I have no scalars and no derivatives. But I could have more than two fermions. And there's lots of other things I could do. Instead of having vectors, I could have had gamma left times vectors. I could have had gamma mu nus in here and gamma mu nus. I could have had no gamma mu's. I could have gamma fives. There's lots of combinations I could make in here. And I could put derivatives in here, too, if I wanted to, and so on. So you can kind of see that there's lots and lots of things you could do. But let's look at the dimensions of all these couplings. So we know that the scalar fields have dimensions of mass, and this has dimensions of mass to the fourth. All right, so that's going to be 4, and this is 1, 1, 1. So this has to have dimensions of mass as well. So this is dimension 1. So that means to say that G, I, J, K has dimension 1. So it's a mass. This has mass to the fourth. So this has to be dimensionless. So lambda I, J, K, L is dimensionless. And if this has n terms in it, this is going to be, this has to be mass to the 4 minus n. So you can see that if n had been 3, we get 1. If n had been 4, we get 0. And anything bigger than 4, we have negative powers of mass. Here, we've got mass, 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 mass. So that was dimension 5. So alpha has to have dimensions of inverse mass. Here we have dimension mass. This is 3/2, and this is 3/2. So altogether, we have 3/2, and 3/2 is 3, plus 1 is 4. So y would be dimensionless. Here we have 3/2, 3/2, 1 and 1. So that's dimension 5. So z has to be dimensions of inverse mass. Here we had 3/2, and 3/2 is 3, plus 2 is 5. So again, W has dimensions of minus 1. Here we have 4 times 3/2 is 6. So this has to be dimension minus 2, and so on. The only things at all that you can write down which are dimensionless or positive powers of dimensions are these, right? There's this one, and there's this one. Everything else has negative powers of mass. So the renormalizable theories are the ones that have couplings which are positive powers are zero powers of mass in them. And so you can see why renormalizability is a restrictive thing. You know, most interactions that you'd like to write down are not renormalizable because the coupling constant they have involves negative powers of mass. Physically, what they mean, you get non-renormalizable interactions if you are asking for the virtual effects of heavy things. And the mass that's appearing in here, which is giving it the dimensions and setting its size, is the mass of the heavy thing that you integrated out and weren't looking at, along the lines of what I was saying in one of the first lectures. So just in a hand, you know, that'll become something which I'm gonna become much more explicit later on in the standard model, because we're going to get things like this, for instance, by removing the W boson at some point. And so we're going to get effective couplings like this in the effective theory below the W boson mass, where L will have the dimensions of 1 over the W mass squared. So the size of L will be set by the thing that it's describing. So in the spirit that these non-renormalizable interactions, the reason they depend inversely on mass is that they're expressing how something heavy has been removed, and that thing is, that by assumption, heavy. These things would be negligible. These things are contributing to observables to order energy divided by this mass, and that the assumption is that the energies you're interested in are lower than the mass, so that's a small correction to things that would be important at low energies. So there's a story there that I'm kind of skating over, which is that renormalizable interactions are justified as being the things that dominate at low energies. And given that that's true, it's really useful, because there's not a lot of things that you can get at low energies. And so it's very restrictive what you can have at low energies. So for example, you know, let me do the for example later on. Let me do it later on. There's an example which you need. That says something interesting, but it helps if you have photons to think about already. So let me just put that off until we have photons. So the most general renormalizable interactions, these are the ones that you see all the time in applications. So you have L interaction is minus V of phi, where V is just this quartic thing. So it's normally, you know, historically you stick the things in here that don't involve no derivatives into V as well. So V would be minus 1/2 U squared A phi A phi A summed over A. I guess I'm using I now. Plus, because of this minus V, the overall minus sign goes away. So what I should have actually done is I should have written this as being minus. Conventionally, that's what you would do. And we have plus G I J K. So you have cubic interactions in the scalar potential. You have quartic interactions. Period. And then the other thing you can have is Yukawa couplings. A Yukawa coupling is, by definition, something with two fermions, one scalar, no derivatives. And it's interesting because it's dimensionless couplings. And that conventionally, actually, that would have also had a minus sign in front of it. And it's, you know, called it historically because that was the original nucleon-pion interaction that Yukawa wrote down. And that's it. Spin 0, spin 1/2, that's the whole story. Anything you do at low energies in spin 0 and 1/2 relativistically has to look like that. And there's a lot of things that could be in there, but that's not kind of as complicated as you might have thought things could have been. So one of these things you do in the assignment is an important part of this whole important part of this whole argument was the dimensions that the fields had, and that came from the dimension that L had, and that came from the dimensions, the number of coordinates you're integrating over. So it's interesting to think this thing through again in different dimensions. If you do this in 2 dimensions, or you do this in 10 dimensions, how many interactions are renormalizable? And you'll see that in some dimensions there's actually lots and lots, and in other dimensions there's none. In most dimensions, there's none, it turns out. It's only the low dimensions that were normalized in the directions. And kind of what's special about four dimensions is that there's some interesting ones that are, the renormalizable ones are kind of interestingly complicated. That's true, I guess, for the lower dimensions, too. You know, for example, let me just do an example. Actually, I think it's in your assignment. Let me not do an example. OK, now what about spin 1 couplings? I want to keep this, so let me get rid of this. So what do we have to add for spin 1? Well, so we need to do the dimensional analysis part of it now. So we have a new piece in the kinetic term, which is minus 1/4, you know, F mu nu. There might be more than one of these things. Let's say alpha, F mu nu alpha. So we have, say, alpha goes from 1 to the number of spin 1 particles. So we can figure out, remember, F alpha mu nu is d mu e alpha. So we know the dimensions of the spin 1 field in the same way. This has dimensions of mass to the fourth. So that means this has to have dimensions of mass squared. So given the derivative here, this has to have dimensions of mass. So the dimensions of A are exactly what the dimensions of the scalar field were. So you can go through and now ask, how would things work? What are the renormalizable interactions for things involving spin 1 particles? And you can right away see that you're screwed if you want to do it with F only. As soon as you write down anything with an F, you're non-renormalizable. Because what are you allowed to do? You could have had F alone. Well, two Fs was already something which was dimension 4. Three Fs could have been an interaction. But that has dimension 6, because there's 3 powers of something with its mass squared. So that's not renormalizable. If you want to combine it with a fermion or a scalar, A has the same dimensions as phi does. So you'd have to have something like, so with fermions, it's impossible, because if you have fermion, and F, then that's dimension 3. F is dimension 2, so you're already dimension 5, so you can't have that in a renormalizable level in the four dimensions. For phi, you've got some potential opportunities. You've got F mu nu. So you might imagine having phi phi or something. That could have been the right dimensions to be dimension 4. But there's the mu nus are not Lorentz invariants. So you need something to contract those indices. And you can't use F, because that would have been dimension 4. And then another phi would have made it non-renormalizable. So you could hope to use derivatives, but you have to use at least 2. So you could hope to have something like d nu phi. But that actually is 0, because this is symmetric under mu goes to nu, whereas this is anti-symmetric. So you could do this. That's actually also symmetric, but you could have, you know, I, j with some coefficient, which is anti-symmetric. But that has dimension 2. That has dimension 4. So this is dimension 6. So this has dimensions of 1 over mass squared. So if you want to build something out of F alone and avoid the gauge invariance story, you can't do it in a renormalizable theory. So at low energies, if you want to have any interactions at all at low energies for spin 1 particles, you're forced to build them with A. So there are no interactions built using only F for which the couplings of non-negative dimension. There are, at the non-renormalizable level, there are things you can write down, like psi bar A, gamma mu nu, psi B, F mu nu, with a coefficient C alpha A B. That's allowed. That's a magnetic moment interaction. But nothing which is renormalizable. At the renormalizable level, you can kind of see that there's going to be a story, because if we decide to use A, we can use things which are nominally Lorentz invariant. So then we could try L interaction could be things like psi bar, gamma mu, or we could have gamma left, gamma mu, psi A, psi B, A alpha mu with some coefficient, you know, H alpha A B. Or we could have things involving scalars. So we could have, we have to get an index mu somewhere. So we could have had something like phi I d mu phi j a mu alpha with some coefficient we haven't used yet. Say f alpha I j. And this would have dimension mass cubed. This is dimensions of mass. So h would be dimensionless. This has dimensions mass cubed, again, phi, phi d. And that's dimension of mass, so this is dimensionless. So these nominally could be renormalizable because they have dimensionless couplings. But this is only really Lorentz invariant. It looks Lorentz invariant because we can track the indices, but it's only Lorentz invariant if this is also invariant under shifting A by a gradient. Using only F and phi and psi, but not A. And that's the coefficient C. There are interactions, but they all have couplings with negative dimensions. So this is dimension of the mass cubed. This is dimension of mass squared. That's mass to the fifth. So this is one over mass. Okay. So this is not as Lorentz invariant as it looks, is the main message, that we have to really ask, how do things, if I shift this by a gradient, is that a symmetry? And if we're talking about A, if we're allowed to use A and not F, we could also have self-couplings of A, right? We could have things like A alpha mu, A alpha nu, A, beta, or actually beta, gamma mu, A delta nu, some coefficient C alpha beta gamma delta. Or we can do things with derivatives, too. We can have things like a da with some coefficient. Those would all have dimensionless coefficients. But the trick here will always be that to be Lorentz invariant, we require a symmetry under a goes to a plus derivative of something. If it was massive, then you could do things. You could write this thing down, and then these would be invariant, and you wouldn't have to care. So you're right, so I should say for massless. I'm implicitly going to keep the massless case in mind because I'm interested in the case where, in the standard model, we're interested in the case where the scale of physics, the theory works to scales bigger than the W mass divided by, 4 pi over G squared or whatever it is. So I'm going to really be interested in the massless case. But for massive particles, you could write these down. And again, it's a limited list, but it's this kind of a list. So how do you make that work? Well, the observation that makes that work is that let's first think about one vector field. So for one massless scalar, spin one, we're asking for a symmetry under A goes to A plus d mu omega. Now, hold that thought and just go on a detour now. We're trying to couple that thing to other particles, let's say. And so we're trying to make things that are the psis and the phis, which have the property that they are going to be invariant under that kind of a shift. So all these things, these particular, so if we're interested in coupling A to other things, these things that we're allowed to try are linear in A, right? So we're interested in an interaction of the form something built out of psi and phi times a mu. And what we'd like to have be true is this be invariant under this. So now, an aside is, let's suppose that we had a bunch of matter fields. And I'm gonna stop writing fermions. I'm gonna just write a generic field phi. But what I'm saying would apply to fermions just as well. It's just that it saves having to write two fields all the time. Suppose we have a system of spin 0.5 fields described by some Lagrangian. I'm going to call it collectively phi. And suppose that this had a symmetry of some sort. So let's say suppose L is unchanged by transformation of the form delta phi I is equal to some function, what do we call it, fi of phi. Doesn't have to be linear, it's just something. So what I want to do is I want to go through what that means is that delta L, I'm imagining, so the statement that L is unchanged means that if I imagine varying fields, L could depend on the fields and the derivatives. So that's supposed to be 0, and it's supposed to be identically 0 for all phi. So it's really a symmetry. It's not the equations of motion that if I evaluate this at a specific phi at 0, it's just symmetry is a statement that this, for any phi, there's a redundant direction like that. So I can do a replacement of phi which has this form. Now let me actually, I want to emphasize, there may be a several parameter family of these things. Let me put in a parameter here, say epsilon alpha f alpha. So imagine that there's some parameters that are describing this. Now, I took the epsilon out of the derivative here. Right, because I'm typically interested in symmetries where these parameters are just, you know, it's like rotations in space where I rigidly rotate every field at the same time. I don't imagine them as being fields themselves. So the typical situation that you usually have is that these parameters are constants. And that's what I want to focus on here. So what I want to ask is, these kind of transformations are not the kind of transformations, you know, I want to make a connection between these transformations and these transformations. Where I'm going is I'd like to say that if I have a system which has a symmetry like this, I can make an interaction like this, which is invariant under this. And so I'm going to want to, but it'll only work if I can relate omega to these epsilons. And an important difference is that omega here can't be a constant because it's being differentiated in this transformation rule. Whereas normally for symmetries, we're thinking about epsilon being a constant. And so it's something which is not varying in space. So let me ask, with that motivation, the question, supposing I had a symmetry like this where epsilon's a constant, but supposing if epsilon's not a constant, it's not a symmetry. So, you know, so for example, let's make it concrete. You know, say L had been we have one scalar field, and our Lagrangian is d mu phi star d mu phi, and we've got a potential which is a function of phi star phi or something like that. And so the symmetry in that case could have been delta phi is equal to I epsilon phi. So it's just a phase rotation, an infinitesimal phase rotation. This is invariant under that for any phi. But it's only invariant if epsilon's a constant, because the kinetic term would not have been invariant if I let epsilon be a function, because the derivative would pick up the epsilon and I wouldn't get something zero if I varied L. So it's important in this kind of a thing, typically, that epsilon is a constant to make it a symmetry. But I want to ask the question, so if epsilon's not a constant, the variation of L won't be zero, what is it? So, question. What is delta L if epsilon alpha is not a constant? If epsilon had been a constant, the variation of L would have been identically zero, because that's what it meant to be a symmetry. But because it's not a constant, it won't be zero. So in that example over there, what I would have had is delta L would have been d mu phi star times I d mu epsilon phi minus d mu phi times I d mu epsilon phi star. And so that would have been, you know, I d mu phi star phi minus d mu phi phi star times d mu epsilon. And all the other terms where I have epsilon involving a derivative on phi would have canceled, because that's the same statement as saying that this thing, if I vary it with epsilon constant, is identically zero. So in general, if I do some variation, this is what would have happened in the example we looked at over there. In general, what we would have had is that variation of L would have been, you know, dl d phi plus. The only difference between this and what I wrote up there is that I shouldn't throw away the piece involving the derivative of epsilon. So if I write this out as the derivative of epsilon plus the derivative of f, all the terms not involving derivative of epsilon are zero, because that's the statement that L was invariant of the symmetry when epsilon was a constant. So this boils down to just dl d mu phi I where I've used this. Now, something I should have said is you recognize this is the there's a line I should have said here. This has the form of the Noether current for the symmetry j mu of phi times d mu of epsilon alpha. Why is that? What I should have done before moving on to this question is I should have done Noether's theorem. What you normally do is you say that if I have this symmetry, I can prove that when the equation's in motion, that thing is conserved, right? So equations of motion normally are dl d phi I. Sorry, I integrate by parts. So I got minus d mu dl d mu phi. Right? So if I take this as an identity and I compare it to that, so I can, I can write this as being the derivative of everything minus the derivative on this thing. And then the derivative on this thing is going to cancel that. So that and that imply that d mu So all I've done is I've said that if I write this as being d mu of everything in here minus the derivative acting on this, then the thing that has the derivative acting on this and this combine to give me zero, because that's this statement. And so all I'm left with is this, which is that. And it's equal to zero because that's what this equation said. So that's the way you normally prove Noether's theorem. So that's why this is defined to be Noether's current. This quantity here is the thing that's conserved by virtue of the symmetry. And so the observation I'm making here is that if I had had a symmetry like that, and if I had gone ahead and done a transformation which was position dependent, even though that's not a symmetry, then what I'll find is that L isn't invariant, so delta L is not zero. But what it is equal to is not some random thing. It's the Noether current times the derivative of epsilon, always. And that's interesting because this thing, you can imagine now combining with this thing to make something invariant. So now notice, if we write L interaction, or let's take L to be the kinetic stuff, so it's L of phi with a symmetry. We also have the kinetic term for the gauge fields. There's only one of them now. And we want to write an interaction term down. We could have written down an interaction term. If we write down J mu A mu, where this is, again, the Noether current for the symmetry, then if we ask, is this thing invariant under this, the answer can be yes if we say that we'll do a transformation, the symmetry transformation, where we allow this to depend on position and we identify epsilon with omega. So what we'll have to do is we'll say, so then the claim is L is invariant, where this L means that L, but this whole L, with respect to delta A mu is equal to d mu omega, and delta, so this has to be a function of x, and delta phi is omega f of phi. So I've just chosen omega to be epsilon. So omega now is by assumption not a constant, that's why that's not zero. But hey presto, what happens is that this is invariant by itself under that. This is not invariant because that transforms, it picks up a d mu omega times j piece. But the variation of this thing is this. It's j times d mu omega, which will exactly cancel the variation of this, provided that j itself is invariant. But j itself is invariant under, if there's only one, if it's an abelian symmetry, j will be invariant. So provided delta j mu is zero. And this provided part is actually for free. If you give me an abelian symmetry, so there's only one symmetry because I've only got one gauge field, then the current for the abelian symmetry is always invariant under the abelian symmetry. So that shows you that the way to couple a massless spin one particle to other things is, or one way to do it, is to find a symmetry that the other things had and gauge the symmetry. So promote it to local symmetry where the parameter depends on where you are in space-time. And then this requirement you had for the gauge field, the symmetry you had to demand of the gauge field will be promoted to symmetry the whole thing, because the failure of the coupling to be invariant is going to be exactly what you need to cancel the failure of the matter action to be invariant, given that you now have a local interaction. So this whole this identification here is called gauging the symmetry. So you've made it into something which is a local function. The parameter is now a local function in position. And you were able to make everything invariant because you've also got a new spin one particle around whose transformation is canceling the failure of your original matter Lagrangian to be invariant. What this doesn't answer is this unique? And so, and it also doesn't tell you what to do in the case of a non-abelian symmetry. If I had more than one massless spin one particle, so I had more than one of these symmetries, the symmetries might not have been abelian. If the symmetries are abelian, so each A shifts by a derivative, and those and they all commute with each other, then this construction would also work again, because the none of the gauge fields will none of the spin one particles will couple to each other. But if you had them, if the symmetry that involved was something like rotations or something which is not abelian, you'll be forced to have this current transform under the symmetry, and so this provided thing is going to fail. So that you have to be more creative as to how that works. And what happens is that the J has to depend on A as well, so that the A's start to couple to each other. So what I'll do next time is, I guess, is to argue why this is the only way to do this symmetry. If you turn the question around and say, well, given what you can do is you can say, I'm not going to actually quite do what I say I'm going to say. But if you ask the question, having seen this example, you say, well, we're looking for local symmetries is what we're really doing. This, I kind of introduced it in an artificial way where I had a symmetry which had involved constant parameters, and I had a gauge field which shifted by a derivative of something, and then I tried to make them the same thing. Basically, this is saying we're looking for symmetry where the parameters are local in space. The question you really want to ask is, how do I do that? What's the most general way I can make interactions that are invariant under local transformations like that, where an important part of the transformation is that the gauge field shifts by a gradient? And it might also have things that don't involve gradients, but I have to have a piece like that in it somewhere. Then the general solution to that problem is that you can build, the Lagrangian has to be built from derivatives of the fields, where the derivatives of the fields are being combined with these gauge potentials in what you call normally a covariant derivative, and the gauge fields are coming into field strengths, which are the things that you normally write down in a gauge theory. So there's a sense in which this gauging of a symmetry is the general solution to the problem of how you couple a spin one particle, a massless spin one particle, to other things in a Lorentz invariant way, given that the Lorentz invariants dictated you had to also build in a symmetry of this form. Yeah. It's not always satisfied, but in the case, if the symmetry you looked at in this example, for instance, the symmetry was this is the current, and that is automatically invariant. So there's many cases in which the current is just automatically invariant, and if you kind of ask group theoretically, knowing what the answer really is, you ask group theoretically, when is it true the current is invariant? That's the same statement as saying that the symmetry you're looking at was an abelian symmetry. So as long as the thing you're looking at is commuting with all the other symmetry generators, that's the same thing as saying the current that you get from it was not going to transform under the other symmetry generators, or any of the symmetry generators. So in that case, when it's an abelian symmetry, this provided is true, and then we're done. But in the case that it's a non-abelian symmetry, the thing that will fail is exactly that, that the current here will not be invariant, and then we'll have to do more things than just that. And what you could do is you could do it by brute force. You could say, well, let's just look at the variation of the current and see what it's equal to. What would I have to add to cancel that? And if you do that, you'll get to the right answer. But there's a faster way to get there, which I'll do next class, which is the promoting of the symmetry directly to a gauge invariant thing, a local thing. Any other questions? I didn't stop for a break this time because having missed two lectures, I figured that we should pick up the pace. But you should tell me, because you know, now you're at the end of like 4 hours of talk. If you find that you're getting burned out at the end of the second session, I can stick breaks in, because putting in more material is not so useful if you're not going to, you know, if you're getting overwhelmed at the end of it. So give me a sense, maybe next class, whether you want to have a break. So I'll see you next week.